Welcome to Dreamland, a program dedicated to an examination of areas in the human experience not easily nor neatly put in a box. Things seen at the edge of vision, awakening a part of the mind as yet not mapped, and yet things every bit as real as the air we breathe but don't see. This is Dreamland.
It absolutely is. Good evening, everybody. Another Sunday evening, another Dreamland underway. I'm Art Bell. Got an interesting show planned for you this evening. Linda Howe, an investigative journalist, an Emmy Award-winning investigative journalist, used to produce TV documentaries and sort of investigated her way into the world of crop circles and animal mutilations. It's a funny thing. I got a fax tonight regarding the very person that she's going to be interviewing, Ingo Swann. And I'll read the portion of that here in a moment. It is a small world. So Linda's coming up from Philadelphia, followed by scientist astronaut Brian O'Leary. He'll be here from Maui, Hawaii. And I have good, very fond memories of Maui, where I once lived, for about 6 months. And so that's on tap for this evening. A couple of notes.
Gas that remote viewing is only 15% reliable. I think it only crossed media this past week.
Nobody knows the real story of remote viewing. The media has no idea what remote viewing is. The American public certainly has no idea. And so they're all getting off on this, look at the government spending, wasting money on psychic research. Well, it wasn't psychic research. It was trend analysis. This kind of stuff going on in the Soviet Union. And it was imperative at the time that threat analysis be undertaken. Everybody improved it from Congress on that. Congress for being regulated for many years. Progress of our project and everything.
But from your point of view, how strong and reliable was remote viewing during those Cold War years?
We had to aim for 65% in order to be competitive with the other conventional forms of intelligence gathering, and we did achieve that.
You would achieve 65% accuracy?
Oh, yes. Well, we wouldn't have been in business without that.
Yes.
We had to become competitive, or compatible at least, with these other conventional forms of intelligence gathering, or we wouldn't have had a penny more.
And if you could be that reliable, then why would there be at this point in the fall of 1995 the kind of release from the Central Intelligence Agency that has just come out that questions this and says it's only 15% reliable?
I don't know. Nobody understands the work of the CIA, do
you? No.
No, I don't think anybody does, and I think that the CIA might not understand their workings a lot of the time, too. I don't know. But I was completely stunned when I was sent a copy of that release. And I think every other person that was involved with the project, there were easily over 500 to 1,000 people, but totally flummoxed, too. So, I don't know. I mean, I've never been able to answer all the questions, and I certainly can't answer that, but I think that the real reason will surface here one of these days. But in this case, some of the documents from 73, 74, and 75 have been declassified. And these are some of the 8 Martini things that Norm Person referred to on the Nightline program.
Well, could you explain for our Dreamland audience what the 8 Martini is?
The 8 Martini remote viewing event is one that is so really astonishingly good that it breaks everybody's realities, and they have to go out and drink 8 martinis to recover. That's what it means.
Did you ever have an 8-teeny remote viewing?
Oh, yes.
can you give that again?
Well, every time I've seen it happen with me or with other people, it's so amazing each time it happens. You never get used to it,
Mm-hmm.
And it just blows your mind. And the really good ones just blow you away.
What would be one of your best?
Oh, one of the best ones was probably the one that happened, one of those that happened in 1973, after I said to the project in SRI that we would offer remote viewing as for testing non-sponsors, you know. So they shipped out a coordinate and there was a big to-do about it. And it turned out to be, I thought that the coordinate was in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I said, there's only water here. And so Dr. Putoff, who was working with me, said, well, I mean, he said, well, the rescue's not here around here. Look around and see what you can see. So sort of in the haze, this sort of land sticking up. And I said, well, there's a seashore. We've got to go over there and look at that. So it turned out that this was an island. And I said, well, I can call it an island, but that's not enough data to show that this is, you know, that just an average guess that there would be an island here. So we decided that I should draw the contour of the island. And we didn't have paper big enough in this locked room we were in, so we had to put a lot of sheets together as I was tracing the shoreline of this island. And it's almost a perfect match for the island, which is for Grillon Island in the South Atlantic. And then I put some buildings on it and everything, and they had some outhouses which were sort of orange tents, and there was bird doo-doo everywhere. You know, the birds were in the numbers, a lot of them, so on and so on. And I said, well, there's some kind of research going on here. But it turned out not only was the contours really recognizable at that island in all respects, but that it happened to be a joint Soviet-French research installation. And when the gossip got out that their secret remote, or the secret research station, had been penetrated by a psychic, they protested. The French and the Soviets protested to Washington unofficially. Yeah, that got into the gossip line too, so we were blown away.
Well, how did they protest, in writing to the president?
I don't know how they protested, but the phone call switchboard was lighting up. Oh boy, what a fuss you've made here.
But you were that accurate.
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at it, you can say 65% very easily, and more, actually. And this is before our project got classified, even. That's been public in the public domain. So that was the first one that really blew us away. Not only because of the remote viewing and the quality of it, but because of the repercussions and the impact it caused.
That you were that accurate that two foreign nations would actually respond to Washington.
But that was a spontaneous thing. You can call that spontaneous RV. It was definitely 65% or more efficient. And do you know what the result was?
What?
We got offered more money.
Right.
Right. Okay, that's the bottom line, right?
And they kept going on like that for at least 20 years.
Yeah, they kept going on like that for 18 years that I know of, actually.
Well, isn't there a point where you were remote viewing at least one Soviet submarine and saw something that was like a disc behind it?
Yes. That was so top secret, that one. And Howard Blum put it in his book Out There.
Right. Right.
And how he got a hold of it just blew me away. Because I know what the tickets were on that one, you know.
Yeah. Well, did you personally, I mean, do you feel at this day it was a UFO behind a submarine?
Well, if you read Howard Blum's book, you'll see the whole thing. He got it all right, except that the table was round and not square.
Mm-hmm.
And there was all sorts of brass sitting there, and Putoff was on my left, and this 2 or 3-star general was on my right, and I was fussing away. They gave me the cord, and I was fussing away. This is one of these big test things that went on, you know, with witnesses, and the room was filled. And so I was doing my remote viewing, you know, boogaloo.
Right.
I finally came across something, and I stopped it in my tracks, and I looked at that, and I, oh my God. So I whispered over in Hal's ear, and I said, Hal, I don't know what to do. I think this submarine shot down a UFO, or a UFO fired on him. What shall I do? And Putoff went as pale as an egg, you know.
Oh my God.
And he looked at me, and he said, whispered back, he said, oh Christ, bingo, it's your show. You do what you think you should do. So I just simply sketched out this picture of the UFO and this bass sitting on my right hand. He grabbed that from me and he said, what's that risky for? And I said, sir, I think it's rather obvious. And he took that paper and he stood up, and when he stood up, everybody else stood up except me and put off. And they walked down the room, all of them. So Peter finally went back to the hotel, and I said, oh gosh, we've blown the program. So we went out and got drunk on margaritas and stuff like that, and went back there, it's all right. So 3 days later, put off, got a call. The call said, okay, how much money do you want?
Wow. Did you ever see anything like that disc again in any of the other remote viewing sessions you did?
No, but, well, not for the, not none of them for the sponsors, but, you know, we did a lot of playing around in private work and things like that, yeah.
And you encountered the discs and into this issue of a non-human intelligence?
Well, this complicates this particular issue. I'll only say that I know we are not alone.
Right. So there it is, from the master teacher and the inventor of remote viewing, that he has a different view on the reliability and the ability for remote viewing to work with other intelligence gathering methods to find some things that they might not have found otherwise.
Sometimes the flow of my program scares me. I don't know how we do it. In other words, we'll open up on some topic during the week, and there you will be with someone following up right on Dreamline. That's incredible. Absolutely incredible. All right, Linda, as usual, we're way short on time. So let us have your address, contact number, fax numbers, date of birth, social security number, or whatever.
Okay. I just felt that this was really important, and it was very interesting to hear right from the inventor's mouth tonight. And me, Linda Howe, my address is Post Office Box 538, Huntingdon Valley, Pennsylvania. The zip code is 19006. And I do keep confidences on names for anybody who wants to communicate with me. My fax number is area code 215-491-9840. And the 800 toll-free number for information about my books and documentaries that have focused on investigations of the animal mutilations, crop circles, the human abduction syndrome, government knowledge, cover-up, all of that. The number is 800-707-9993. That's 800-707-9993. And I always look forward to hearing from our viewers. There are some amazing stories out there.
Well, you're still back in your TV days, unless they're staring at the grill of the radio.
Listeners.
Yeah, there you are. All right, Linda, wonderful, right on the money report, and boy, there's a lot to think about out there.
Good.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Art.
Take care. That is, of course, Linda Howe, and generally, I think she is, she hates me to say this, but she is the leading investigative journalist, we'll put it that way, into crop circles and animal mutilations. All right. Because Hawaii and Dr. Ryan O'Leary. Doctor, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Art. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you. I spent 6 months on Maui. It's a beautiful place to live.
Yes, it is. And I just moved here a few months ago, so I'm just getting acclimated. And actually, most of that time I've been on the mainland anyway, going on a tour of my new book. So I'm glad to be back here and glad to be relaxed and glad to be on a show with an intelligent interviewer for a change.
That's very kind of you. I take it you've heard the program.
Oh, yes. Well, I was on Area 2000 a few years ago, so I remember the interview very well.
Well, you're also able to hear it there in Hawaii. I don't know if you knew that or not, but it's on KHVH.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. You can hear it right there.
At
any rate, so you were an astronaut, eh?
Yeah, that's not really, that's certainly an impressive credential. I was in the astronaut program in 1967 and 68, and that was just, of course, that was during the Apollo program. And I was appointed to go to Mars. I just completed my PhD work at Berkeley about Mars, and I was selected as an astronaut to go to Mars, and then cut it out for the program. And when that happened, I
Yeah, before you sort of disavow that, though, Well, you know what I'm interested in?
Well, I disavow it relatively speaking because my whole life has been intensive research over the last 10 to 15 years on the paranormal, UFOs, free energy, and so
on. Oh, blah, blah, blah.
That will fill the bulk of our
okay, we're going to get to that. But what I want to ask you about is that magic moment, if you can remember back, way back when somebody notified you that you were actually going to go to Mars. Now, obviously then you thought, hey, I'm going to go to Mars. What was that like?
Oh, it was exhilarating, and it was really quite a process to be selected, too. Alan Shepard was on the interview committee, and he said, would you submit to a hazardous two-year journey to Mars? And I kind of hemmed and hawed a little. I said, well, I think I would, but I don't know whether my wife would like it.
Yes.
And
did you go home and ask?
I liked that for an answer. So then he said, you'd better want to, and I said, yes, so okay, that's fine.
So you didn't go home and ask your wife first?
Well, you see, that of course, those were the days of the right stuff. I had crew cut, I was a fresh PhD from Berkeley, and, you know, it was those were the good old days in Apollo. It was a time to be there, because NASA in those days had a vision, a purpose, and a goal.
What about now?
No, it's I see a lot of these federal agencies, NASA, the Department of Energy, the DOD, and the CIA, and all these secret agencies as being more and more bureaucratic dinosaurs. They really have to do with the realities that are unfolding around us.
What do you think happened to our vision, Doctor? We did have a vision. I mean, Kennedy inspired it. We're going to the moon, and then we were going to go to Mars. And now, you know, we barely even can get excited about putting up a shuttle.
I know. It's very sad. It's very sad to see of the loss of vision. And I think it was because, Kennedy was murdered, and it was his vision. And so it just kind of floundered. It just kind of died. Other politicians like Johnson and Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon tried to stimulate some interest, but by then the peak interest had waned.
There's so many things wrong with our country now, Doctor, that not having a goal, not having a vision, used to unify us as a country, and we just, you know, the biggest goal for most people now is to make it to Friday.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, and that's when I started to get out of my box when I was on the faculty. It was interesting, your introduction, you said facilities at Cornell, Princeton. I was actually in the faculty. I was a professor in each of those universities, but when I was at Princeton in 1979, I myself had a remote viewing experience. I heard the interview with Ingo Swann. It was most interesting. And it just totally violated my paradigm at that time.
Well, let's
look. I was in the physics department at Princeton being a proper mainstream materialistic physicist.
Yes. Why don't you tell us about it? Are you willing to tell us about that?
Sure, I'll tell you a little bit about it. It was, I was sitting opposite a total stranger. It was the last day of a training or a workshop. This one happened to be LifeSpring. And it was my first experience at trying out some of these exercises to get a person into a state of us and blissful meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of prepared me and got me into a state. And I started to, I was sitting off a total stranger who gave me the name of a man, his age, and the fact he was from Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I was supposed to have this person guest, start talking about him. This woman, who was the total stranger, knew the man very well. So I started describing him, and I said he was a journalist and meteorologist, and he liked to spend a lot of time on Maui and lost his wife by death, all of which happened to be true. So at that time, given my worldview at the time, my perspectives, at first I was exhilarated, but when it was Monday morning and back to work as usual at Princeton, I recalled that my colleagues would love to chatter about claims to the paranormal being pure bunk. So I began to realize that, hey, these weren't the folks for me to share this information with. And somewhat ironically, right around that time, Robert John, who was the dean of the School of Engineering at Princeton, started his experiments on psychokinesis in the basement of the engineering department. And he told me what he was doing, and I didn't tell him what I was doing, but I was off to workshop and start to have these different experiences, and I started to explore these realms beyond normal materialistic science, and that's what really started to open me up.
Are you at all privy, by the way, to any of the results you obtained in that area? I've always been very interested in psychokinesis.
Oh, yes, yes. And in fact, you know, that's another thing in your introduction I want to elaborate on a little bit is that I've done a trilogy of books, and I call it my New Science Trilogy. And the middle book is called The Second Coming of Science, and I devote a whole chapter to the landmark research of Robert John, and that's spelled J-A-H-N, Robert John, and Brenda Dunn and their colleagues at Princeton University. And their work basically, it started as building up a database on people's influences on random event generators, and these are electronic boxes that spit out binary numbers, zeros and ones, and they're designed to run randomly. The zeros and ones are generated like about 100 per second randomly, and then an operator goes into the laboratory and attempts to influence the results one way or the other. And these are a number of different controlled trials where they would get results, and what they found was that virtually everybody that went into the laboratory, you don't have to be an Ingo Swann to do it. It's you and me and anybody else can actually influence the random event generator and a somewhat repeatable pattern.
To what degree?
That's personalized, that is okay. Matched with the person's own identity.
I understand. To what degree? What is the best they achieve, do you know?
Well, you mean the mind over matter effect,
yes.
About one part in 5,000, but I can elaborate on that story and talk about filtering techniques to amplify effects to as much as one part in five. But at any rate, if you just take the data cumulatively, you find that in the trials where people attempt to influence the results, you do get results, and sometimes it's opposite of intention, mm-hmm. But the point is it's non-random. And so they've been doing these experiments now in Princeton for now 16 years, the same length of time that I've been exploring new science. And their results, I think, are very important. It provides the database you need from a scientific perspective to establish beyond any reasonable doubt that psychokinesis is real, that, in other words, we humans can, in fact, virtually all of us can influence outcomes in the material world. And that's a very exciting result.
We can influence outcomes. Can we influence material objects? In other words, can we actually produce, has anybody documented, I know the Russians have worked heavily on it, physical movement of an object with the power of the mind?
Oh, yes. There have been a lot of experiments on that, too. I myself haven't attended any of those, but probably the most dramatic demonstrations of that kind of thing that I've seen in my world travels, and by the way, my trilogy is based on my world travels photojournalistically. I've been around the world many times, and Tomas Green Morton in Brazil, I visited him. He's written up in The Second Coming of Science, and he was able to, like, bend spoons at a distance. He was able to materialize perfume from the back of his hand and roll down his fingers to the
wow.
fingertips and form puddles on the table. And there was a case, about the 8 martini. Well, he had a fifth of rum. The more that he drank, the more he was able to do, which is kind of the opposite of Sai Baba, who is another very, very talented. He's an Indian Swami that's very well known, and I have now visited him privately and personally or with small groups on 4 occasions now over the last 3 years, and I've seen him manifest many, many things out of thin air.
Doctor, that leads us down an interesting path. The influence of chemicals with regard to attaining some sort of altered state. Now, you mentioned alcohol. What about the what about the large group of drugs in the LSD family, that sort of hallucinogenic type thing?
Well, I'm not too familiar with those experiments. I know folks like Terence McKenna and others have looked at that, but I know that in some instances it can elevate one's psychic abilities. And by psychic abilities, I mean any number of things like psychokinesis, teleportation, remote viewing, and all of these other phenomena that involve the mind-matter interaction.
Fascinating. That's a brave statement to make. A lot of people wouldn't make it. Now, would you say these things, and did you, when you were on the staff of these academic facilities? Because you
Well, obviously not.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations, it's just like the UFO phenomenon itself. The more you look at it, the more you realize there's something to it. And most scientists, the people who call themselves scientists, are so smug as to sit in their armchairs and deny evidence that's very obvious.
Well, you know, John,
you have to go to some effort to
yes.
to observe it, and in my case, to go all the way to India and see Sai Baba and be able to get in to see him personally, which was in itself a miracle.
Well, you know, John Mack has spoken out at Harvard, and you know what happened to him for that.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh. I tell you, I mean, I really feel for John. He's a good friend and a close colleague. And I was at Princeton before I started to come out of the closet in these matters, fortunately. So I didn't have to suffer the heat that John Mack has had to suffer. But the positive thing, of course, about staying is that he can have a great deal of influence on further directions of research, and his research is very valuable and important.
All right. Now, I'm going to get into a very sensitive area with regard to remote viewing. I had Major Dames on the other night and interviewed him. I'm sure you're familiar with the name.
Oh, yes. SciTech.
Yeah, that's SciTech. That's correct. And then I had another doctor on following him. Both of them said the same thing. Major Dames, only a very quick reference to it. But there's been some experimentation with remote viewing, and those in it say they have contact with non-human intelligence. What do you know about that?
I don't know about the SciTech work, to be honest with you. I haven't researched that. No, not
specifically. I just meant as a general rule. Have you also heard this?
Well, I have kind of tangentially, but again, I'm not a real expert in remote viewing. I had my own remote viewing experience, which then triggered this whole new paradigm of science for me and made me just totally change my life. And that was my purpose of pointing that out. But I would check that out with Engel Swan or some of the real experts in that area.
Mm-hmm. Well, he clearly said we are not alone.
That's great. I think that that's another then thread, at least, of evidence. You can't, of course, give 100% certainty. It's interesting because a lot of people think that the claims I make are far out, but not really, because I'm a very, very cautious scientist, basically, and I seek the scientific method wherever possible to attack questions.
Well, how do you act, as a matter of fact, we've got to take a break, but when we come back, I will ask you how you attack the UFO field scientifically. I would like to know that, because that's what we try to do here. Maybe that'll give us some leads. We'll be back to you, Dr. O'Leary, in just one moment. Why put up with those hard water spots on your glassware, windows, and cars? Why do you keep putting up with the crusty lime buildup in your sinks, faucets, shower walls? You know how annoying it is, so why wait? Call today and order GMX Magnetic Water Conditioning. Join me and my wife and thousands of other homeowners who are using this no-salt, no-chemical, no-maintenance way of controlling our hard water problem. Just measure the size of your main water line, get out your credit card, call in today, and you can have GMX protecting your home within 3 days. A $600 one-time investment protects your home from hard water damage for a lifetime. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back, and guess what?
And I would think that, first of all, the scientific method is of course, the method that's used now within the context of current science, which I think can tell us a lot more than we've given ourselves credit for. And certainly in the UFO phenomenon, such things as the ground traces and animal mutilations and multiple witness sightings and, all of the relatively hard evidence, I would say, is something that comes from the scientific method, more or less. Mm-hmm.
A lot of it
is a collection of data. The problem is now is the interpretation of the data. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, where there are as many theories as there are investigators. And part of the problem there is that the UFO phenomenon obviously has such a high degree of weirdness that we have to be humble. It's sort of like the... A Coke bottle falls out of the sky and you're a bushman, and what do you make of it? Or an Aboriginal is walking through the bush and he sees a 747 flying overhead. He'll have his own mythology about what's going on, but he won't have the foggiest notion of what's really going on, besides certain threads of evidence that come out with such things as, of course, reverse engineering at Area 51 and genetic engineering through the abduction phenomenon and so forth. the ecological crisis and mandate and various channeled works and so forth. All of those things are common threads of messages that seem to be coming forward, but we still don't really know what's going on. The whole question and debate, it was interesting. I was just at a briefing of the board of directors of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and Steve Greer of CSETI and Jacques Vallée and I made presentations about all of this. And although Vallée and Greer and other people might have various interpretations of it, what's going on, we really don't know. We do know one thing, and that is that we're dealing with dimensions beyond time and space. And obviously, when we get into those realms, it's very hard for us to develop some kind of coherent philosophy or theory. That's what makes it so laughable for folks like Carl Sagan, God bless him, to assert that the UFO phenomenon is just hallucinations and abductions are hallucinations, and to just totally and summarily dismiss the evidence from crop circles and from the anomalies on Mars and so forth.
Why do you think he does that? Do you think he has a specific agenda?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I taught with him at Cornell. We were both professors of astronomy at Cornell way back in 1968, and I worked very closely with him, but that's before my own worldview shifted. It was before I myself considered it okay to look at UFO phenomena and related phenomena. Mm-hmm. But I can say one thing is that folks like Carl, there is a very strong ethic within what's called the scientific community to stay inside the box, and it's peer pressure and funding. Those are the two big variables that guide the research choices of scientists like Sagan. I know because I was there. I did it myself for many years. I was in the mainstream. So I know how that works. And it's
so in other words, for fear of losing some funding, you might not utter a sentence or a word you might otherwise utter.
Oh, that's right. That's right. In other words, when it comes to belief system, and boy, there's been some really good research done on this, and we're really right up against it. I just, of course, finished my tour in my new book, Miracle in the Void, and I went all over the country, figure eights, and doing whole life expos here and there, and doing radio and television, and I really got a sense that what we're dealing with here is that many people have such strong beliefs that they don't want to hear about this stuff.
That's right.
And it's fascinating that people who call themselves scientists are among the worst offenders. Science to me is the quest for the truth through whatever means, exploratory means, definitive, repeatable experiments, mm-hmm. and so forth. So what I've taken upon myself is to be like an Indiana Jones of science, if you will, and spend the last 10 years as I have in this just an inexhaustible quest for the truth.
How much heat have you taken over it?
This last tour, I took a lot of heat, and we'll get to it later in the show, of course, but free energy is a concept that's coming along a lot more rapidly than many people will acknowledge, and this is really, in a sense, independent, but somewhat overlapping with the UFO phenomenon. The people are producing energy devices now that produce virtually unlimited electricity, and this is popping up all over the world. Well, the UFO credibility rating, according to Gallup polls, as we know, is in about the 60% range publicly in America. The free energy credibility rating is much lower even. And so what we're doing here is actually we're creating a new paradigm. We're really in the middle of a scientific revolution.
All right, Doctor, I'm going to have to ask you to hold it right there. We've got news coming at the top of the hour. I want to ask you about zero-point energy. I also want to ask you when we come back, since you've got a PhD in astronomy, about Hale-Bopp, and we'll do that when we come back in a moment.
You know.
And Dr. Brian O'Leary. Doctor, can you tell us anything at all about this comet, this Hale-Bopp?
Well, no, Art. I wish I could. It sounds like some of our questions are mismatched, but that's okay. But I can make some recommendations of people for you to interview about that. You see, what happens to me is that if I focus on an area like free energy or zero-point energy or the UFO question or the face on Mars,
right,
I really focus on it for quite a while, and then I'm not as aware of all the breaking stories.
All right, well, that one's breaking. There's a big one out there beyond the orbit of Jupiter, and it's going to miss us by quite a bit, 1 to 1.5 AU, somewhere in there, but it's a big one. I thought I would ask. Let us then go back to what you do talk about. I've got a fax here from Phoenix, Arizona. Please ask Dr. O'Leary what he thinks of Hoagland's Mars mission work, the face on Mars, the monuments of Mars?
Okay, that I can address quite well, because that's an area that I've been quite involved, heavily involved in the research. And by the way, I want to let your listeners know that Dick Hoagland is one of several researchers who have looked at this in great detail and have published papers in the peer-reviewed literature.
Yes.
And there's also, of course, the McDaniel Report. So what I want to do is kind of just fill you all in on the status of research and so forth, is that a number of years ago, Hoagland and others noticed that this very strange object that was photographed by the Viking orbiter in 1976 on the surface of Mars. This is an unmanned reconnaissance probe that was sent up then. It took a picture of an object that looked like a large mesa that resembled a human face staring straight up into space. It's about a mile across and quite large and looks very sphinx-like, almost with a headdress. And when the scientists first looked at that, and I know these people very well because I was involved in the Mariner missions myself as a scientist at JPL and so forth, that these people, because the possibility that it might actually be an artifact just was so totally alien to the world view of the scientists that were present, after a little nervous, self-conscious laughter, that looks like a face, they pronounced the object being nothing but a pile of rocks that just resembles a human face, just like sometimes you look up in the mountains around Greenland there and see faces in rocks. But as the sun changed its angle, Vince DiPietro, a researcher for Goddard Space Flight Center, and Greg Molinar noticed that there was a second picture in another orbit that showed the face at a different sun angle, and it was still very face-like.
Yes.
And so Dr. Mark Carlotto and I and others, using state-of-the-art image processing equipment, published in the peer-reviewed literature, places like Applied Optics and Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, some very provocative papers that suggest that these features, especially the face, could be artificial. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is that the three-dimensional structure of the face is very face-like. And so this caused a very interesting controversy. Some of us banded together and wanted to influence NASA's decision-making in the Mars Observer mission, which was launched 3 years ago, which would have provided much higher resolution pictures of the face, to have them target the face as a high priority.
Right.
And that simply didn't happen. And
well, as a matter of fact, my understanding is, Doctor, that they fought it tooth and nail. In other words, they did not. They specifically said they would not go back and look at it again, and that seemed odd because they didn't have any other things that looked like faces on Mars.
Yeah, there was a political process where they were in denial for a while, and then were provoked into saying, "Well, okay, we'll look at it," but then. You see, one of the ironies of this is, of course, when Mars Observer, two days out of orbit from Mars a couple of years ago, when it was coming into Mars, totally lost the signal. So,
So
we got nothing.
Correct.
And, of course, there have been allegations that perhaps NASA actually did get pictures but was covering them up, and other allegations that, well, maybe there's some alien activity around Mars because Phobos 2 of the Soviet Union also failed when it got to Mars. So there are a number of speculations, but that's the realm of speculation. The realm of solid research suggests very strongly that these objects are artificial constructions. And if they are, obviously this is an extremely important element in the whole search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And the fact that NASA has been stonewalling this through the years was very eloquently stated in a report by Professor Emeritus Philosophy Stanley McDaniel at Sonoma State University. And he wrote what's called the McDaniel Report. And he looked at what scientists call philosophers call the epistemology, fancy word that basically means how do we know what we know, behind investigations into these features. And he became very surprised to find that the responsible outside investigations that some of us had carried out through the years were in the peer-reviewed literature were certainly far more solidly based scientifically than the allegations against and the ridicule, the obfuscation, the propaganda issued by NASA and by Carl Sagan on these things. Carl wrote an article in Parade magazine. He seems to like to do that. In this particular one, a number of years ago, one of the pictures of the face appears to have been doctored from its original version, which really, you know, this really gets me concerned, because these are the people I used to work with, and I thought scientists were totally honest in their approach to scientific questions.
Richard Hoagland's work is based on something that he calls tetrahedral physics. Now, have you examined that? Have you looked at that?
I haven't, to be honest with you. You know, each of these subjects could take a scientist months to do, so I have to make my choices, and it's very difficult to do so. I do know one thing is that Dick Hoagland, I admire his work a lot. He's an excellent speaker, and I think he has a lot of very valid points to raise. However, sometimes arguments based on geometry or latitudes and that kind of thing, I think, need tighter criteria to pin it down, if you know what I mean.
All right, let us skip then quickly to the moon. He has said, has photographs that he claims show shards and what he claims may even be old buildings or cities on the moon.
Those photographs are very controversial. There are some folks that definitely defend that point of view, and there are some others that don't. And so I think the jury is still out on that, just like the alien autopsy footage. Allegations like that, I think, take years of in-depth work. And fortunately, in the case of Mars, that has already been done, thanks to Stan McDaniel and also Dick Hoagland and Mark Carlotto and a number of other investigators. All of us worked together for a number of years to come up with the findings we did come up with, and they're all reported in my books, by the way, as well. So
all right, let's skip then and jump and.